You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at KBOO.FM.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4. Now through April, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our fantastic programmers, including specials for Black History Month and International Women's Day. If you'd like to check out our specials, go to kboo.fm/ATNF4.
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If I's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, wish there's a mole in the ground.
Good morning. I'm Fran Michelle, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio station, bringing you the All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4 special programming campaign going on now through April. Check out the list of specials at kboo.fm/ATNF4. Today, for instance, is the last day of Women's History Month, and if you missed the live comedy show on Friday of Women Doing Stand-Up, you can hear the recording tonight at 10 p.m. on Comics Take on the News. Here on the Old Mole, we do tend to be a lot less humorous about current events, even if contemporary politics can often seem like a joke. Portland City budget, for instance. Every year we hear there's a budget shortfall, not enough money, the sky is falling. We're told we have to cut programs and sell off city property. No more parks and rec programs. Let's cut health benefits for city workers. Let's cut emergency services, because surely we won't be having any emergencies, right? I did say it was a joke. Meanwhile, the Portland Clean Energy Fund pulls in more money than expected because it puts a teeny little tax on rich businesses. Funny how that works. Most of us find taxes burdensome, even a hardship, but it turns out that if we collect it from the people and companies that have a lot of money, there can be plenty to go around. Today on the Old Mole, I'll be talking with economist Mary King about how all this taxation business works and how it could work much better. Then, for more about how we can make the city better, Lori Mercier will be talking with Alicia Chavez of the Portland Association of Teachers about the April meeting of the Portland Rising Workers Assembly and their work toward aligning community groups and labor unions to make the city better for everyone. So stay tuned to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. As ever, in a day or so, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show and its segments on our website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can also find a link to subscribe to our show, and you can click on the red Donate tab in the upper right corner to help support local independent media. Or you can support KBOO by texting KBOO to 44321, or by snail mailing your support to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. We turn now to the first of two segments today of my conversation with economist Mary King, who explains the need for taxes and the inequities of current property taxes in Oregon, and who proposes several ways to raise state and local funding to support housing, healthcare, education, and more. Good morning. This is Fran Michelle here with Mary King to talk about taxes. Mary King is an economics professor emerita at Portland State University, a columnist with Portland Street Roots newspaper, a former candidate for Oregon State Treasurer with the Working Families Party, and an activist and organizer here in Portland. Welcome to the Old Mole, Mary King.
Thank you for inviting me, Fran. It's great to be here.
So taxes. Taxes get a bad rap. Nobody likes taxes. Nobody wants to pay taxes. We've heard for decades people saying they're too high. Read my lips. No new taxes. Government can't do anything well. It's too big. People feel like it's a burden. Why do we even need taxes? Let's maybe start there.
Well, really good point. And we have heard for decades loads of anti-tax propaganda, well-funded by people like the Koch brothers, other wealthy people, for, you know, probably since Social Security passed. And so we're flooded with it. And people don't even realize how much they've absorbed the idea that government can't do anything right and how little it's based on. But there are certainly things that only the public sector can fix. I mean, things like, can we end houselessness? Can we build affordable housing? Can we have health care for everybody? Can we have affordable or hopefully free and high quality childcare? All kinds of things and even paved the stinking roads, you know. And the quintessential example in teaching econ is streetlights. You're not going to get streetlights with a market. And that's the kind of thing people had to tell Soviets when the wall fell and they were going private is, no, markets won't do everything.
So you can't just fund streetlights with advertising.
Turns out nobody will buy them.
So taxes aren't too high then.
Well, taxes are too high for some people and too low for others. That's really the key, is we do not concentrate our taxes at the top, where policy and the economy have been shoveling all the economic gains of the past several decades. We've let the taxes fall. A lot of people may not know that for 50 years in this country, the highest income tax bracket federally was over 70%. And, you know, that ended with Reagan. And the Democrats have just never fixed it. And we go back and forth, but only in tiny increments. But we needed to be taxing more at the top. And that's part of the problem that people don't understand with underfunding the IRS in the way we have. Very conscious. It means that it's cheaper and easier to audit people with low incomes. They have simple tax returns. And we audit far more people who are taking the earned income tax credit, only available for parents with low incomes who are working, than we do people with complicated tax returns and lawyers on retainer, frankly. You know, but that's where we're losing the money, and that's where the big incidence of cheating is happening.
So we would have more money if we were not underfunding the IRS.
Yes, we would. And, you know, the state mirrors the federal tax return. So if people had to clean up their federal tax returns and they lived in Oregon, we would benefit from that.
So we're not going to contract things out or have streetlights paid for with advertising. It's not cheaper to privatize things or handle things ourselves privately or through mutual aid. I mean, do we need to have the government involved?
We do. We need to have that level of coordination and that level of resources. We just can't do it these other ways. I mean, mutual aid is great and it's fantastic for community building and community defense kinds of actions and meeting some needs, small needs that people can get together and do themselves. But to go to scale, we have to have the government and tax dollars. And I don't know how they sold us the bill of goods that privatization is cheaper. That is just not true. You still leave the government with all the costs of administering contracts, which nobody thinks about. What about that? 9 zillion contracts. And then just look at what we do privately. We have the most expensive healthcare in the world. We're spending much more per person, as if we spent it on everybody, than all the rich countries. We have worse outcomes. And it just isn't the case. I mean, we cut in all those insurance companies. We don't need health insurance if we have health care. All those profits, all those high exec salaries, it just isn't true. And even pushing things out to nonprofits is a problem. The only way it becomes cheaper is you lower wages or something like that. It's just not cheaper to privatize. It only becomes a profit center.
Okay, so we might actually feel better about paying our taxes if we were getting better results, if we were getting more in return for the money we paid, instead of just seeing it evaporate into the hands of the wealthy. So we need taxes for things that private markets or mutual aid can't do or can't do well. And obviously, at this point, we can't really count on the federal government to address these issues that are so pressing: housing, healthcare. Federal funding for these things is being cut, not increased. So we seem to be going in the wrong direction there. But if we could raise funds at the state level, is there a way to do that without having to count on the federal government to come to our rescue?
Well, there is. I mean, you're absolutely right. We cannot count on the federal government. And really, we haven't been able to for a long time for so many things. But now it's going to be dire, as we know. And it's really a shame because we send all our income taxes off to DC and all we get for it is the world's most ginormous military. So that's a whole issue. Much easier for us to be able to try to affect things on the state and local level. And there are things we can do here. Start with the state. We have capped the property tax in the 90s through measures 5 and 50. And it limits the rate, it limits how much can be collected, and it has meant much less money for the schools and local governments. Whereas in 1996, we were still paying property tax on 100% of real market value. Now, statewide, that average is half and a little lower even in Multnomah County. So needs have grown, the population has grown, and the property tax is not growing along with it. So one of the results at the state is that the state is now paying well more than half of the funding for our schools, which used to be much more reliant on property taxes, which means just then the state isn't really fully funding education and it's not funding all the other things at the level we need either. But there are things we can do about it. And those things, I would say, just to speak quickly, how we can raise money and should raise money at the state level. One would be to put another tier or two on top of our income tax. We're very dependent on income taxes in the state, especially personal income tax. 85% of our funding comes there. And our top rate is 3.5% lower than California's, for instance. So the entire state of California and all those cities has a top income tax rate of over 13%, and we're at 9.9. We should raise some up. We have many more wealthy people than we used to have in Oregon. We tend to think of ourselves as this small little backwater economy. We're not anymore. There are a lot of resources here. Another thing we can do right away would be to try to avoid giving so much money back in the kicker. And that's a tough one. It's impossible to predict well. I mean, we set off the kicker all the time because it happens if more money comes in than was predicted by the state economist's office 2 years ahead of time. That is not a possible thing to do to get accurately. And they have to err on the conservative side, because we can't budget more money than we're going to have coming in. And the other issue that isn't clear to most people is that what is especially variable in the income tax take is due to income on capital gains. That is just not predictable.
Can you explain for our...
Yes, good idea.
Capital gains?
Capital gains are when you sell an asset, like financial assets or property, and you pay gains on the increase in value over the period you held that asset. So that is considered income, capital gains income, and you get taxed on it like other forms of income. And that varies tremendously because there are sort of fads in how people go with selling their assets that are like the fads in the stock market. Like, oh, we're going to take our earnings now, our gains, and cash them out and lock them in. And you cannot see that coming. And it's what has kicked the kicker in this state the last several years, is capital gains were high. And the way that we can avoid having to pay back so much money to the wealthy in kicker payments would be to put capital gains income tax revenue into a separate fund. Don't put it into the general fund, which generates the kicker. Put it into a fund for the schools or for housing or for wildfire fighting or all three. Put it into a fund for anything we desperately need. And then we won't set off the kicker in the way that we have.
And if we do, people who need the money back will still be getting it. But that capital gains money is not going to be going back to the people who already made a lot of money in their real estate deal.
Exactly. And capital gains are very concentrated at the top. Very. So the rest of us need not worry about it. This is not going to affect us. We are not going to experience this. Another thing I'd really like to see us do, and that's a bit more visionary, is I'd like to see us run a state ballot measure for a wealth tax. And we think about our property taxes, that's only on real estate, real property. And, you know, that's owned by the middle class. So they pay the property tax when people who own their own house. But it's also paid by renters because landlords are able to include the price of their property taxes into the rent, especially in a tight housing market like we have, an expensive housing market. So working people and the middle class are paying property taxes, but nobody's paying taxes on financial assets, which are the bulk of wealth for the wealthy and very concentrated on them. And we could have a wealth tax in this state, taxing financial assets. Emmanuel Saez, who's an economist at Berkeley and was an advisor to presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren when she was proposing wealth tax, has estimated what we could bring in this state with a wealth tax just on financial assets, really, or on everything apart from real property. And with just a 1% wealth tax, we could bring in on people who have 30 million in financial assets or more, we could bring $1.5 billion a year in.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, there, you wouldn't think it, but there are 2,300 households in Oregon who have 30 million in financial assets or more.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I think people don't often think about that difference between income and wealth.
Right. And we use those terms kind of intermingling, but most of us don't have wealth, you know, or we have a house, but we don't have much beyond that. Whereas the wealthy, and they're here, they're not just all in New York City, and they should be paying their fair share. It's the only way we tax wealth in this state is through an estate tax. And we take in so little in an estate tax. I looked up the numbers for 2019-20. Then the estate tax was bringing in $267 million a year, or a quarter billion. At the same time, property tax revenues were $7.5 billion, 28 times as high, and that's being paid by renters and homeowners. We should be taxing the wealth.
So we can take some of that, even if it's not money that's coming in newly to them, like capital gains or wages, mm-hmm. wages being what most of us get, capital gains, some more people get. But that wealth increase is something that only is really affecting the very, very wealthy, those 2,300. Wow, that's a lot of people.
It is, because those are households. So that's right. Yeah, wealth is what you have, what you just own, and income is what's coming in, just as you say. So, and we're not looking enough at wealth. And the thing is that the numbers I quoted, that's just a 1% tax. I mean, why not tax 3% or 3% if you're over 100 million or something like that? You could easily do it. And the thing of it is, people are earning money on their wealth. You take away 1%, they're probably still, or 3%, coming in far ahead.
They're still going to have to pay it the next year.
They actually are. That's right.
So those are some aspirations for bringing in money at the state level.
Tax the rich, feed the poor, tell their rich no more.
That was a bit of the 2017 remaster of 10 years after performing I'd Love to Change the World. And before that, economist Mary King explaining the need for taxes and how Oregon might improve its tax code. We'll return to that conversation in a moment, but first, let me remind you that I'm Fran Michel, and you are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Thank you, listeners. We are currently in KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills Volume 4 special programming campaign, going on now through April. You can find the list of specials at kboo.fm/ATNF4. And tell your friends. Share links to some of the great programs available there and all over the KBOO website. Okay, we return now to economist Mary King talking with me about local taxes and the city budget. What about locally? I mean, we're facing big budget deficits at the city and the county. Much more locally, we've got tight budgets and we're looking at where are we going to cut? And that it seems like there might be some ways to bring in money instead of just dispensing with services that are already being cut to the bone.
Right. We need to stop cutting our community centers and everything else, you know, parks and rec. We have to stop. Everybody needs all those things. We need more Portland Street Response. We need the city to step up more on housing. Absolutely, we do. And there are a few ways that we could go to raise revenues in this town. And one that's kind of quirky, we have this inequality tax that Steve Novick actually got started when he was on the city council that says, look, if your CEO is earning 100 times or more than your median employee, the person in the middle, you're going to pay a little more on your business license tax. And if they're earning 250 times more, you're going to pay a little bit more. But the thing is, they were very little bits, very little bits. It's like your business license tax and then plus 10% or plus 25%. Well, let's double it. Double your business tax, triple your business tax. It's not that much. And especially these corporations that have such high earning CEOs, they aren't even going to notice what Portland is asking for. So that's one thing. Another thing.
I got to say, I love that we have an inequality tax.
Isn't that cool?
And we should definitely do more with that.
Yeah. They kind of made it more boring. By now they call it the pay ratio surcharge, but it is an inequality tax and we should have kept its name. They're also, you know, we need to shift budgets around. The police budget needs to be reconsidered and shifted. We need to quit all this expensive arresting and jailing of people on the streets. Let's shift some of those resources and catch some of these speeders who've been killing people at bus stops and that kind of thing. That ought to pay for itself. And then the police are also sitting on a big pile of money that they end up using for overtime that they're supposed to be hiring more people with. Well, if they hired people, we would pay less because they wouldn't be earning overtime, but they're not doing it. So we should just take those funds, put them in our reserves. We need to bulk up our reserves right now. And then we can see if they can hire, they can see if those are available to ask them back. So those are some ideas.
And the police budget is already, it's the biggest chunk of the general fund, which is the only part of the city budget that's discretionary, that can be moved around because other parts of it are locked in. So that's where the money is. And if we need to take some, that's where we would, it would make sense to get some of it.
Absolutely. And to add insult to injury, we're paying out the big bucks in settlements for people, for police misconduct, for people that the police have victimized, brutalized, and that doesn't come out of the police budget. And it's well into the millions.
Wow. So it's police do something wrong, kill somebody, injure somebody, disable somebody, and that person sues in order to get recompense, medical bills paid, try to slap the hands of this institution of police who are repeatedly harming people. They're recognized as having a good case. They get money, but they don't get it from the police. They get it from the rest of the city budget, from parks and Portland Street Response and all the things that people need and want. So yeah, yes. That seems a bit awry somehow.
It does. All the things that we have literally voted for, like PSEF and Portland Street Response. Absolutely. And yeah, that has to change. And I suppose it will change. We're going to need better vetting. We need to also fire people. We need better training. We need real discipline in the police force rather than, oh, sure, that was defensible. Not at this price, no. I think a few other ideas are we really need to audit and take a look at Prosper Portland, our economic development agency. They're just in the news for giving a $7 million loan to people who don't have a business plan strong enough to get private loans and have already gotten money from the state, which says, that's it, no more from us, to do manufacturing in Old Town. Who does manufacturing in the middle of the city anyway? They need more oversight. They need more guidance. And on not only their lending, but on what you call tax increment financing, which is where they get a loan on behalf of some developer to do something, and then they pay off that loan with future property tax. So it steals the property tax from our schools and our local governments in order to induce development in areas that are supposed to be blighted. But you'll notice when you look at the list, they include, for instance, the South Park blocks. So how are these are well beyond blighted areas. When I first learned, spending my time at PSU, that PSU was in a blighted area in need of this kind of giveaway of the property taxes, I couldn't believe it.
Tax increment financing is often justified as a way of building affordable housing or improving the economic picture of a blighted neighborhood. So as you say, these neighborhoods are not necessarily looking very blighted and therefore not so much in need of special help for development. But what about the affordable housing argument for tax increment financing?
I regard it sort of as a red herring. I mean, the ends do not justify the means. You need different means. Yes, we need affordable housing. We don't need to get there by giving away property tax revenues. We have other ways to go.
And what are some of those ways?
Well, some of the things that I've been talking about really here, other ways to raise funds. We can do our own bonding. We have a very good bond rating. And we can pay back with other means. I mean, the city of Chicago is paying back bonds with their parking meter take. So there are alternatives.
So how else can we raise money for affordable housing or other things that we need for the city?
Well, one way that we could do it potentially is to create a tax very similar to the Portland Clean Energy Fund tax, the PCEF tax. That has been tremendously successful at raising money. And it is a tax only on the very biggest retail businesses that operate in Portland. So it's your mega big box stores. They're global corporations that bring in more than $1 billion worldwide and more than half a million here in Portland on their revenues. And they're bringing in far more than the city economist anticipated or anybody else.
It's bringing in more money, and it's been so successful that other agencies are trying to raid that fund. The PCEF fund is specifically designated for climate and clean energy, and sometimes there are attempts to stretch the meaning of that and take funds out of that very important basket that we need to address and move it to other things. So, but you're saying we could have a parallel tax or a change in the tax in order to not just steal from PCEF, but enhance the kind of revenues we're getting from PCEF.
Exactly. So that structure of a tax just on retail is bringing in a lot of money. Well, there are many other industries that we could be taxing a similar tax for other purposes. So housing, for instance. Let's have a look at, say, finance, banking and finance. I would love to see some estimates of what we could raise with a similar tax on other industrial sectors that are operating in Portland that are immensely huge and profitable when you think about how big they are worldwide. And the one fear about doing that is that as part of passing the Student Success Act statewide, which like PCEF is a gross receipts tax based on total sales of an entity, they preempted localities from creating further gross receipts taxes. Well, we already had one, so we're grandfathered in. And I think we ought to argue that. We ought to test it out at a minimum and say, yep, we're just applying this tax that we already have to another use and another sector because we already have it on the books. We have this tax and try it. It's a big money maker. Another thing that we ought to do right away, and that is audit and consider ending the contract with Portland Business Alliance. They have these enhanced service districts all around town with the so-called clean and safe district downtown. And they charge high fees of practically everybody who's located within the downtown, including our public institutions like PSU and the county, hospitals, everybody, condo owners. They charge high fees at the same time they're whining about, oh, we can't pay taxes, we can't afford that, it's killing the downtown, but they can pay fees, there's no problem there, that makes no sense. But they rammed through a big expansion of the downtown area just this late fall with the lame duck city council, raising the fees, expanding the number of people who are going to pay it. And we need to have a look at this contract. This contract pays between half and three quarters of the salaries of seven staffers, including their CEO and president, their vice president for government relations, and their executive director. So these are their highest paid people. We're paying half their salaries.
And this is the same group that is the biggest lobbyist of the city council. And when we look at who is talking to city council and who is trying to influence them, they have paid lobbyists from the Portland Metro Chamber of Commerce who are there more often than anybody else gets to talk to the city councilors. And they're lobbying against raising taxes, even though they're also lobbying for raising these fees that go through their bank accounts.
Yeah, absolutely right. That is a critical point. It is a very corrupt situation, very corrupt. And also, as you mentioned, they're now calling their lobbying wing the Portland Metro Chamber. It's still under the umbrella of the Portland Business Alliance, as are the enhanced service districts and their PACs, their political PACs that fund a certain kind of candidate to run for city council and county. So it's that same organization, and you're right. It's a very corrupt relationship given how much they lobby.
And so in effect, taxpayers are paying them to lobby our city council to cut the services that the rest of us need. That seems wrong somehow.
It seems wrong somehow. It does. It really does. And they've been very effective so far. So much so, speaking out as if, you know, Portland downtown is just a terrible hellhole now, and everybody is avoiding it, and they can't do business there anymore, and so all the taxes have to be cut. But I recently saw a city economist memo that said, guess what about downtown office buildings? They're only paying 4% of the property taxes that comes into the city. So why are we listening so much to what they want and rolling over for them?
They come out with this economic state of the city report every year, and they've been talking about there's a doom loop or something, that things are terrible. Every year they seem to say, we need to cut taxes more, we need to fund these fees more. They're part of the argument that we don't need taxes, that taxes are bad.
Yes, you're right. The annual report that they give, everything is terrible. The language they're using right now is really over the top. We're in a doom loop, spiraling down. And you would never guess to hear that language that, in fact, household incomes have doubled in Multnomah County between 2012 and 2022, still rising by half if you adjust for inflation over that period of time, that the number of high-income households in the city nearly doubled in just 4 years. Those are households with 200K plus in annual income. Unemployment remains historically low. The poverty rate fell dramatically in the county from 2014 to 2022. So this is a pretty weird kind of doom loop.
Some of that may be people who are now too poor to afford to live in the city, moving out to someplace cheaper, but it sounds like it's not a case of the wealthy fleeing because Portland is in such terrible shape, and maybe they're not going to be fleeing if there's a little increase, teeny increase in the taxes on their wealth and incomes.
No, you're absolutely right. When you look at the age distribution, what ages are falling locally, it's people under 34, it's young families, it's families with children and young adults, and those are people who are looking for more affordable housing, more house for their money. That's who's leaving. And we have no good evidence for the claims we hear constantly that wealthier people are leaving to avoid the taxes. If you look at some of these same figures that they're looking at, people staying in the county have the same average income as the people leaving. Only there are many more of us staying than leaving. And they compare it with people moving in have lower incomes than the people leaving. We're like, right, because people moving in are generally young, you know, and that's been a great source of vibrancy for Portland, has been a lot of young people moving in, and many of them with college educations and other kinds of qualifications, ready to move and shake and make things happen around here. But there's no good evidence, and there's no good research in general that people move to avoid taxes. And when you look into why, it just makes sense. People want to stay close to their businesses, close to their schools, close to their jobs, in their neighborhood. Some of them have an awful lot of money sunk into a house. You're going to pay a lot to a realtor to sell and buy, and then you're going to commute from Vancouver? I don't think so. I mean, Washington doesn't even have an income tax at all. And yet people have not piled over into Vancouver, except mostly for more affordable housing.
So it's not reasonable to worry about people moving away because we might raise their taxes a little bit if we need more funds to backfill the losses that we've had because of cuts in property taxes or caps on property taxes that have left people in unfair situations. But these are also, I mean, the wealthy who are putting out the propaganda that you can't raise our taxes, we'll leave, Portland's in a doom spiral, government is bad and must be cut. So how do we make the things we need to have happen, happen? I mean, rich people who have the money have the resources to fight any attempt to share the wealth. As you say, with the IRS, it's much easier to audit and claw back the errors that poor people made in their filling out their taxes than to get that money back from the people with fancy lawyers and accountants who have moved their money, hidden their money, sheltered their money in ways that have undermined the structure of taxes nationally. So how do we address this? How do we fight against people who have so much in the way of resources and power?
Yeah, the scales are really weighted that way. But what we have is a pretty progressive electorate and a strong capacity to organize it. I was part of the campaign for universal preschool in this town. Successful, free preschool for everybody, paid for by a tax on the 5%, and with higher wages for preschool workers and just a number of choices for families. We have the strongest public preschool program in the country. And we got it through people power. We got it through organizing. We got it through people collecting signatures, talking for 2 years to people on the streets and in groups. And it was very effective. It was very effective. And I think we can look at the same thing. The Portland Business Alliance just put the big bucks into our city council and county elections. They went down hard. Their candidates went down hard. And we now have a much more progressive and representative city council and county board. County board wasn't so bad before, but city council, the East Side had no voice effectively at all. And so I think that's what we have. And locally, we can be very effective with people power and hopefully statewide as well. Particularly, I think we're in a moment when people are looking for a way to make change. They're looking for a way to be effective. And I think we can accomplish things in this town and probably in the state as well.
We don't have to just take a chainsaw to everything, and we can stop them from taking a chainsaw to everything.
Absolutely.
I worry some about the new structure of the city government in that it seems to have given a lot of power to the mayor and to administrators who aren't elected. So there have been a few decisions that most people would have thought would go through city council, that city council thought would go through city council, that might have gone through city council, which is more responsive than in former years. But instead, some of those decisions have gotten shunted off to administrators. And it seems like we still need to be alert to what's happening in the nuts and bolts of how decisions are being made and to apply pressure on maybe the mayor and administrators while providing support to our city councilors who are really still trying and struggling to do the right thing and sometimes having their agency cut out from under them.
I think you're absolutely right. I think we expected this was a weak mayor structure, and yet it looks like the mayor comes in earlier into the decision-making process and with more influence on the staff, perhaps. And then the staff has more power than we realize, the city administrator and the deputy. And I'm hopeful that with time, our city councilors, with our support, are going to figure out how to be part of the conversation earlier, even if it's not the formal conversation, the actual decision tree line, but the conversation so that we set some expectations about where the support in this town is, what people want. And the two examples that are top in my mind as you raise this question, one is Zenith land use permit, and the other is the mayor sending Portland Street Response out with the cops, which is exactly what they don't want to have to do. You know, so yay, expand Portland Street Response, but do not pair them up with the police. They're trying trying to develop relationships of trust and personal connection, and going out to people with the police is not the way to accomplish that. I know that the city council is working on revisiting Zenith. I'm sure they'll stay strong on Portland Street Response, and we will have the opportunity in early April to be watching and having input on the city council's participation on the budget. And I know they're working and thinking on it now and in communication with community organizations. So I'm hopeful there.
Thank you so much, Mary King, for talking with us about taxes and how much we need them and how much we need to restructure them and fight to get the services and the things that we need in our city and our lives.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity. A lot of people just think taxes is the most boring thing to talk about. I can talk about it for weeks and days and completely believe that, like budgets, how we tax is how we put our values into action.
We've all had our troubles, troubles made us blue. Been running round in circles, not knowing what to do. We've all had to worry, worry made us sad. But soon we'll have no worries, and soon we'll all be glad.
When our old age pension check comes to our door, we won't have to skimp and worry anymore. Every dog can have a bone, every kid an ice cream cone, when our old age pension check comes to our door.
That was some of the Sons of the Pioneers singing When Our Old Age Pension Check Comes to Our Door. And before that, economist Mary King explaining taxes and how we might save the Portland city budget from its recurring cycle of panic and draconian cuts. Social Security pensions, of course, come to our doors through the federal government, which created the self-sustaining program in the 1930s, back when people agreed on the quaint idea that it was not a good idea to leave old people dying in the street. And in case you've been hearing those rumors, no, Social Security is not being paid to dead people, and the fund could easily be increased by lifting the income cap, since the Social Security payroll tax only applies to income up to $176,000. So the folks making $500,000 a year, or $1 million, or $10 million, are not paying any more than those making $176,000. Anyway, all of the federal government's moves to undermine Social Security, closing offices, firing workers, making it harder to apply for benefits, might well give you the blues. So you can check out the Women in Blues special from Blues Junction earlier this Women's History Month, still available for your listening pleasure at kboo.fm. I'm Fran Michelle, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. And KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills Volume 4 special programming campaign is going on now through April. You can find the list of thrilling specials at kboo.fm/ATNF4. You could also try to cheer yourself up by weighing in on the Portland City budget in the coming days by participating in upcoming listening sessions. Tomorrow, Tuesday, April 1st, from 6 p.m. to 8:30 in the Portland Building, room 108 at 1120 Southwest 5th, and Thursday, April 3rd, from 6 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at Portland Community College Cascade, Moriarty Auditorium, 5514 to 5518 North Albina Avenue. Both of those are also available to attend virtually. You can also submit written comments about the city budget anytime. Find out more about the budget and ways to get involved by visiting portland.gov/budget/join. In addition to those listening sessions hosted by the city, the group Portland for All is hosting an event about the budget on Sunday, April 6th, from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. at the Somali American Council of Oregon, 12409 Northeast Gleason Street. And if you want to contribute to KBOO's budget, you can text KBOO to 44321 or click on the red Donate tab on the KBOO app or on the website at kboo.fm. Next up, we hear Laurie Mercier talking with Alicia Chavez about the upcoming Workers' Assembly on the Power of Coalition, organized by the Portland Rising Committee of Jobs with Justice, and happening Saturday, April 12th from 10 a.m. to noon.
Good morning. I'm speaking with Alicia Chavez, Vice President of the Portland Association of Teachers, which will be co-sponsoring the Portland Workers' Assembly meeting on Saturday, April 12th, 10 a.m. to noon at the Portland Association of Teachers Hall on Northeast 8th Street. Welcome to KBOO, Alicia.
Hey, Laurie. Thank you.
Well, tell us about the April 12th event and how it builds on the March Workers Assembly meeting held. What happened then, and what do y'all hope to achieve in this second assembly?
Yeah, so the goal of this group is to kind of amplify voices and struggles of workers and marginalized communities. The meeting taking place on April 12th is bringing together union members, labor, community leaders, activists, in order to strategize on collective actions, building solidarity, advancing the fight for workers' rights. And co-sponsors of this event could include labor unions, community organizations, maybe activist groups. And about the March Workers' Assembly, it kind of focused on laying the foundation for ongoing organizing, building relationships, and highlighting the urgency of collective action. The discussions really centered around organizing strategies, solidarity around different sectors, community organizations, and labor, and preparing for more larger coordinated actions and what that would look like. And this April 12th event is going to aim on building more on the March event and that momentum by kind of discussing concrete steps for community and labor coalitions to take and how to keep energy and the commitment alive around demands. And so kind of creating some actionable plans that bridge the gap between each individual's struggles and to hopefully create larger systemic change.
Right. Well, I understand that the Minneapolis Labor Community Organizing Project has been really has sort of spearheaded this idea for Portland Workers Assembly and developing these kinds of coalition and organizing strategies. What can we learn from the Minneapolis experience?
Yeah, I believe that Minneapolis has been a key example of successful labor and community organizing, especially in the context of union power and community engagement. The labor and community coalitions in Minneapolis have showed how strong solidarity between workers and local communities can lead to huge, significant gains. And they effectively used collective bargaining power to push for policies and changes that benefit not just workers, but for the community as a whole. And a lot of their campaigns, in my opinion, were more than just the amazing things that they won, because they won some amazing things. But it was also about building like the political anger at a system where corporations made billions in profits while workers are paid poverty wages. And I feel like Portland can learn from that model. And by forging stronger connections between labor and grassroots organizing and community organizations, and particularly in sectors like education, like us, and healthcare and service industries, but also naming those bad actors we have here in Oregon and people who continue, the billionaires that continue to not pay their fair share here in Oregon. I mean, we can name, there's four of them, you know, and there's a lot of people who continue to make a lot of money in Oregon while our schools continue to be not fully funded.
Can we name those four?
Oh gosh. Right now, I know one of them is like Nike, Columbia. I believe the other is Dutch Bros, and maybe the fourth is Intel.
Well, we'll hear more after the 12th, right?
Yes.
When groups come together to identify the billionaires in our community who aren't paying their fair share. Well, speaking of billionaires, we're facing innumerable threats and challenges from the Trump administration. But we see people are rising up across the country in protests these seem like spontaneous protests at Tesla and Social Security offices. People who are outraged about this kind of dismantling of the administrative state and what actually benefits people in this country. So how can we build on this energy and frustration in this moment to actually build power in our communities?
Yeah, I think protests at places like Tesla and national parks and stuff are a clear indication that people are frustrated and ready to rise up. I think it's a key. The key is now that we're going to turn that frustration into organized power and turn those people into organized power. And this requires developing community organizing strategies that go beyond just like one-time protests, like just staying at Tesla and just leaving, and focus on building sustainable grassroots movements that we're building together rather than just one-time things. And I believe that that's what we're trying to do, right? This assembly can help foster those connections between workers and community members, and that we're ensuring that we're not just reactive, that we're proactive. We constantly say that in the education realm, is that we don't want to be reactive, we want to be proactive. And we're creating long-lasting changes in a local context here in Portland. And we could do that through multiple ways, coordinated actions, we could build power, shift that balance of power through our working class communities.
Are there lessons from last year's successful Portland Association of Teachers strike that might help us think about or advancing these community labor coalitions and cooperation in Portland?
Yeah, the PAT strike, I think, provided a valuable example of how labor and community coalitions can win significant things. We had so much parent and student and community members join in on our strike lines, join in our rallies, and PAT had some big wins, and we won some important improvements for our classrooms, and we protected public education as a whole for Portland public schools. And I think that these lessons can help build stronger coalitions, and those coalitions we have seen, like a lot of people come out from leaders from the strike. Like our current city council vice president is a teacher, Tiffany Koya Mullane. We have an amazing student strike leader, Jorge Sanchez Bautista, who's running for Portland school board. So we have seen how the PAT strike and our coalitions are changing things and can continue to change. And it's crucial, right?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I know one of the models perhaps from the Minneapolis effort or outcome was the UAW's call for a May Day strike in 2028. And it seems like a lot of folks are wondering if 2028 is soon enough. I mean, could we visualize some kind of general strike in Portland or some kind of massive mobilization here that might really advance our efforts for a more democratic, progressive community here?
Yeah, the UAW's call for May Day strike in 2028, I think, represents a long-term vision for labor action. And I have heard that argument that we can't afford to wait 3 years for that mobilization, given the current like political climate, particularly around the threats of the Trump administration. But I think while planning for a May Day strike, it's important to also like concurrently plan for building movement that we can respond to current threats and capitalize on kind of the rising frustration and energy in our communities that are happening right now. I mean, we know that the Trump administration is not going to stop at, you know, ending, like last week it was stopping at the Department of Education. It's not going to stop at that. I mean, today I saw that the Trump administration is targeting sanctuary cities and states like Oregon, like we are a sanctuary state. And I was just in Chicago last week, and the president of Chicago Teachers Unions said, like, this is the fight of our generation. And I think that, you know, this is going to allow us to harness that energy for immediate action while also preparing us for long-term strategies to get to the May Day strike or the May Day action in 2028 and what that's going to look like. we don't know, but we could continue to organize and we could show up from 2025, 2026, 2027. And I think it's important to acknowledge that, you know, May Day is International Workers' Day, and it has been a significant day for advocating for immigrant rights. And this is something that immigrant organization or immigrant rights organizations have been doing for years and kind of like following their lead and joining in coalition with their demands as well.
Well, will some immigrant rights groups be participating in the April 12th event? And maybe you can mention some other groups in addition to Jobs with Justice and PAT who might be participating?
Yeah, we're working on solidifying some of the groups that are going to be working with us. And we're definitely going to be making personal asks on some immigrant rights groups as well. And we're hoping to have a really robust coalition together.
Well, finally, let's announce the event again. It's the Portland Workers Assembly meeting on Saturday, April 12th, 10 a.m. to noon at the Portland Association of Teachers Hall, 345 Northeast 8th Street. And Alicia, who should attend and who should folks contact for more information?
Yeah, I think anybody, this event is a key opportunity for activists, workers, community members, leaders to come together, strategize, build a collective vision for the future of Portland and our nation. I think that this assembly is open to anyone interested in learning more about labor and community solidarity and how we can collectively fight for our rights. They can contact Jobs with Justice. They can also contact the Portland Association of Teachers as well.
Okay, we'll post some of those contact links on the Old Mole website, on the KBOO website. And Alicia Chavez, thanks so much for taking time out today to join us. Good luck with all your work. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
January 20th, a dire fateful day, when the Nazis think they've won, and on the streets the KKK is marching to the old beat of the fascist USA. But our union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever.
That was Solidarity Forever 2017 from Ezra Faust. And before that, Lori Mercier talking with Alicia Chavez about the Portland Rising Assembly, about the power of coalition, coming up on Saturday, April 12th from 10 a.m. to 12 noon at PAT Hall, 342 Northeast 8th Avenue. The venue has a wheelchair accessible ramp and masks will be required and provided. By the way, at last count in 2024, there are three billionaires in Oregon: Phil Knight of Nike, Tim Boyle of Columbia Sportswear, and Travis Borsma of Dutch Brothers Coffee. But there are also over 500 millionaires in just the Portland metro area. You can find my sources for that information, as well as more information about the Portland Rising event and about all the segments on today's show, by visiting the pages for this episode and its segments at kboo.fm/oldmolevarietyhour. And you can find more thrilling radio by visiting kboo.fm/ATNF4. I'm Fran Michelle, and you have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio. We are currently in our All Thrills, No Frills Volume 4 special programming campaign, going on now through April. Hence that special list at kboo.fm/ATNF4. Thank you for listening to KBOO. Thank you to Mary King for talking with me about taxes and Portland's budget. Thank you to Lori Mercier and her guest, Alicia Chavez, for their conversation about the April 12th event for Building Labor Community Coalition. Thanks to Joe Clement for performing our theme song. Thanks to KBOO's staff, volunteers, members, and listeners. You can soon find audio for this show at kboo.fm/oldmolevarietyhour. And while you're there, you can subscribe to our show, and you can support KBOO by clicking on the red Donate tab in the upper right corner of the webpage. Stay tuned to KBOO for Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein to hear about gaslighting and greenwashing and the class action lawsuit filed by customers of Northwest Natural Gas over misleading claims at the heart of the Smart Energy Program. The Old Mole will be back next Monday. We'll go out with the Pet Shop Boys asking, what are we going to do about the rich?
What are we going to do about the rich? What are we going to do about the rich? What are we going to do about the rich?
Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO's Metal Marathon, the Metal